Thanks again for showing up tonight, everyone. We appreciate you coming to this night. We're really happy to have all of you here. Thanks so much for coming. And my name's Randy Eccles. I'm the general manager at WUIS. A few weeks ago, Kelly McEvers happened to come into the station and didn't realize for a long time I've been wanting to be able to get her to do something for the station. So she was happy to do something to help out the station and has some ties to the station in the past where she did some freelance reporting for us for our summer version of Illinois Edition. So in just a moment, we'll hear from Kelly. But first, I again want to thank you. This is a fundraiser for the station tonight. So thank you, Kelly, also for being able to make this happen and everyone for buying tickets. It really does help to make it so we can continue to get information out to the community and share all the wonderful things that are going on, whether it's news or the arts and everything else. So again, thank you. But before we have Kelly come up, I would like to introduce Chancellor Susan Cook. She is our University of Illinois Chancellor, and Susan, if you'd come up and say a couple words, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Randy. Well, what a delightful evening. I'm sure the conversation at every table has been just as delightful at the table where my husband and I have been. We've spent most of our time talking about all the things we love about public radio, and I imagine that's the same conversation that some of you have been having. So I've been thinking all day about this group that would be getting together tonight and looking forward to being with all of you because, of course, I'm talking to the choir here. You know, we're all everyday listeners and we're all so appreciative of public radio. Let me say I am so grateful to all of you for your support of public radio. Of course, we couldn't do what we're doing through our public radio station here in Springfield without the support of all of you, so we really appreciate it. You know, as Chancellor of the University of Illinois at Springfield, there are certain things that really are sort of the hallmarks of excellence on our campus and on any campus. For us, you know, one of our very top ones is this wonderful public radio station, as all of you know, even better than I, because I've only been here about 3 years. But our folks at this, our team at public radio station here, are absolutely top-notch people. They're very, very dedicated, and they are really our outreach into the community more than anything else that we do. And we appreciate the opportunity to be so embedded in the community, and I'm looking forward to hearing our speaker tonight. So thank you so much for joining us.
I think it was about 5 years ago when I started as the development director at the station, and during one of the pledge drives, I believe Kelly's mom called up and mentioned that her daughter worked for NPR, and I said, really, what'd she do? And I found out she was reporting somewhere around the world. I go, really? Well, we need to try to get Kelly in. And so after a few years, she was sort of busy. Beirut, Chechnya, wherever the different places have been, there are a lot of them, and she'll tell you about them. But fortunately, she's here tonight, and I don't know if you got to hear her documentary Monday that we aired at noon and again at 7, but it was amazing, and it made me really understand, to some extent, the challenge of being a foreign journalist and the buzz of being a foreign journalist, an international journalist, and a war zone journalist. So I hope you have some questions. Kelly's going to tell you a few things to get going, and then we'll have some open questions. So, and also, just to let you know, that documentary, I've talked to a few people who haven't heard it, is available to stream online at WUIS.org. So if you'd still like to hear it, you can, and I'd recommend you do. Thanks. And now I'd like to introduce Kelly McEvers.
Hey, this is like old home week. This is so awesome. It's so much better than going to other stations where I don't know anybody. I know almost everybody here. Come to Illinois, I get things like fall, which I haven't seen in a lot of places I've been around the world, horseshoes, the food that is not otherwise not found in nature, bumper stickers that say, Illinois, where the governors make our license plates, which I think is really good. I've dealt with corrupt regimes before, but, you know, I feel like I have a new challenge if I come here to work someday as a reporter, right, Amanda? What I want to do is I'm just going to tell you my story a little bit, not because I think it's super special, but because I think it will help us as a group kind of think about this idea of mission. I've been thinking a lot lately about mission. When I was a foreign reporter, when I was working overseas, when I was working in the Middle East, I thought, well, what is my mission? Why am I here? And I think as public radio listeners, you probably think about mission a lot too. You have a mission. You're listening to us because you kind of have an expectation of what we can do for you. And we obviously have this very kind of lofty mission at NPR, you know, it's to serve the public good. But, you know, our mission is changing all the time. Me as a reporter, my mission constantly was changing. And obviously thinking about mission and whether or not it was more important than my own safety or my own family was what ended up, you know, getting me back here to the States. I'll get to that. But, you know, I mean, radio is this really intimate, personal thing, right? You can be in your car doing your dishes, and I can be 10,000. Sorry, I'm getting some little feedback there. I should do better with a microphone, right? I'm a radio person. I can be 10,000 miles away, and I'm in your ear, you know, and talking to you. I mean, when we're doing our jobs well, we're talking right to you, and we're trying to make sense of a world that might be 10,000 miles away, and we're trying to bring it all the way back home. I mean, that in and of itself is a mission. When I sit down every day in whatever weird, crappy hotel or ugly apartment I'm in where I've, you know, spent a day out reporting and I'm sitting down to file my story, I'm thinking about who's listening. You know, I'm not thinking about my editor, I'm not thinking about my colleagues, I'm thinking about, okay, who's listening? What? How can I make them stop doing their dishes, maybe slow down the car a little bit safely, and just listen. And I think that's sort of the mission that we kind of share. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about myself, to talk about my mission, how it's changed. Hopefully that will help you think about our mission together. And then I really, really would love you to ask questions, because I think that's the most interesting thing we could do, is sort of talk to each other, if that's okay. I started out, I'm from Lincoln, Illinois. I grew up in Lincoln, not far from here. And went to college at University of Illinois, Champaign. And I had a lot of different plans, right? I was going to be a lawyer. I was an accountant. Oh, yeah, that was a really good idea. That makes so much sense, right? And then one day a friend of mine said to me, you know, you should, you know what? I know why. Bill Clinton was in office, and his wife, the First Lady, Hillary Clinton, was visiting the campus. This was 1993 or 4. And a friend of mine was going to see her. And I said, how did you get to do that? And she said, I work for the newspaper. And I was like, what? How does that work? She said, yeah, I'm a journalist. You know, we go. We see important people. We watch and hear what they say. We ask them tough questions, and we write about it. And I was like, well, and somebody pays you to do that? You know, I mean, I really just, it never really been in my purview to imagine that that's something that you could do for a living. And she was like, you know, you probably ought to try it. And so there's this great newspaper in Champaign called the Daily Illini. It's the morning newspaper in Champaign, and they'll let anybody walk in the door. You can just go in, and they'll try you out. If you're terrible, they'll politely ask you to leave the next day. But if you're okay, they'll let you stay, and they'll actually pay you. It's an independent news organization that's independent of the university. So I tried it out, and my first assignment, I think, was to report on some kind of arcane change in housing policy in Champaign, Illinois, that was going to mean that there weren't going to be as many Section 8 beds available to people who needed housing. I mean, it was just some kind of really minuscule change in policy. And I was like, well, I need to go to the homeless shelter and, like, go live there and see what they think. And you know, and I stayed. It was like a tiny little, it was supposed to be like, you know, a few inches of a story. And I stayed for like 2 days in the homeless, like, skipped class. Sorry. And you know, I was just like, this is huge, you guys, you have no idea. Like, this is a really big, important story. And like the next, when I finally sat down to write the story, which is the hard part, you know, the next day it was like on the front page, and that was it. That was all she wrote. Like, that was it. I mean, that is what I do, and that is what I was going to do for the rest of my life. And so I had a mission, you know, for the first time as a young student. I had a mission. I had something that I knew I wanted to do. I wanted to do something, a job that where you could, it was like you were in school for life. right? Because every day, not just go see Hillary Clinton or go to the homeless shelter, but every single day your assignment as a journalist is to go out into the world, learn something new, figure it all out, and then tell other people about it. That just seemed like such a great mission. And so that was the beginning of it, and I ended up working at the Chicago Tribune for a few years, and then saw all my heroes, of course, were the international reporters. Right, and as a young 28-year-old, I was like, I want to be just like them. And they were like, yeah, right, get in line, kid. You know, I was like, it wasn't going to happen overnight. They're like, you and everybody else at this newspaper want to be a foreign correspondent. And I was like, well, that doesn't seem really fair. So, you know, on the advice of many good editors along the way who said, if you want to be a foreign correspondent, maybe you should just go be one. I called up my parents one day from a payphone and said, I think I'm moving, if I recall correctly, I think I'm moving to Cambodia. And they were like, from Chicago? Why would you do that? Because I found this job at an English language newspaper in the capital of Cambodia, and I've been told that if you want to be a foreign correspondent, the best way to go do it is to go be one. And nobody said no, and because they would never do that. And I moved to Cambodia and took a huge pay cut and started yet another sort of part of my mission. And it was then that I decided to really be a foreign correspondent. It was then that I was encountering not just, you know, sort of state and local governments, but prime ministers, people who had been involved in movements like the Khmer Rouge, you know, things that were deeply embedded in our memory from the Vietnam War and Americans' involvement in that region, people who committed things like genocide, you know, large-scale crimes against humanity. All of a sudden, I'm a 29-year-old, you know, knocking on the door of some guy who was later going to be indicted by the International Criminal Court for committing a crime against humanity and just being like, hello, excuse me, can you please, you know, tell me your story, because I think he didn't answer the door. But at least I tried, and it was, I sort of had a new, it was a new mission, right? It was moving on from being a reporter in America to being a reporter in the world and figuring out how to do stories that would that somehow sort of draw that dotted line, right, back from me over there to you back here. And I moved along and eventually started in radio. It was kind of a fluke. I was at a New Year's Eve party, and the correspondent for the BBC at the time was going on an assignment in Korea, and she said, does anybody here at this party know radio? And I was like, you know, yeah, sure, I do, which was not really actually true. I'd, like, been interviewed by someone on the radio once, and then I'd maybe, like, done some audio editing on my computer a couple of times, but I didn't know, I just did not know. She's like, okay, good, I'm leaving town, it's fine, you'll just fill in for me, nobody will call you, it'll, you know, this is the BBC, right? So I was like, okay, sure, you know, it's fine, it's Cambodia, like, how much news happens in Cambodia? Not much. So she said, you know, I'll just give them your phone number. And 2 days after she left, I got this call, hello, babe calling. And we're taking you to London. We need to train you on how to be a journalist on the radio. And I was like, okay, sounds good. Went to London for 2 weeks, learned how to be a radio journalist. It was a complete fluke. And at the time, I remember all my friends at the Chicago Tribune saying I was making the biggest mistake of my life, leaving newspapers. glad I did. So it was complete luck. Again, new mission. Had a new mission. Telling stories, and I was really bad at it for like a really long time. It was like baptism by fire. I went back to Cambodia. I was beep calling, and every time I'd send the story, and I remember, you know, years later, I was still getting like checks for like $27. It was like I was not making any money, you know, but I just kept sending a story, and then I'd try to make the one story into a story for another show so I could sort of cobble together a living. And I was terrible at it for a really long time. But I remember thinking that maybe, as somebody who was on the speech team in high school and was really into theater and stuff, maybe radio wasn't such a bad idea. You know, a place where, like, you get paid not to only just go out and learn something new every day, but you get paid to, like, talk. That seemed kind of fun and interesting. And not just talk, but tell stories. And here's where it happened there, and it only grew was this idea that, you know, we order our world in stories. You know, everybody's been to a funeral. Everybody's been to a wedding. Everybody's had someone pass away. You know, there are universal things about human beings that maybe if you're hearing a story about someone in Cambodia who suffered under the Khmer Rouge, or you're hearing about someone in Egypt who suffered under the Mubarak regime, and that person has something in common with you, it might be that you're going to listen. You know, if you're hearing their story from start to finish, Ahmed was a carpenter, you know, Soteri was a teacher. You know, if you start a story in a way that's like common and universal somehow, that somehow that might help the world make a little bit more sense. So my mission kind of changed at that point to become kind of a storyteller. And then through many steps that I will not go into too much detail, I ended up in the Middle East. I finally got my chance at NPR. My joke with my old editor was that I was literally knocking on his door for 10 years, and he was always like, "Why not? I opened it when you were ready." You know, which is probably true. I wasn't very good for a long time, and then I finally figured out like how to do stories in a way that made sense for NPR, and he offered me a job in Baghdad in 2010 and moved to Baghdad. It was the end of the U.S. occupation in Baghdad. It was the end of the war. I was never really all that interested in war, actually. And I was really interested in, telling stories. So here was this great chance to speak to Iraqis, the people who had been affected for almost 10 years by this conflict. And for the first time, Iraq was actually safe enough that we could go out and go be around and be among Iraqis and talk to them and interview them and listen to them. I could travel. I've been in every corner of Iraq. And I'm so grateful that I was able to do that because, you know, I didn't do stories about U.S. soldiers because by that time there were U.S. soldiers there, but it was a very small footprint. They weren't really allowed to leave their bases. There wasn't these embedding reporting trips like there used to be. It was really just going out and being with Iraqis. And again, trying to tell the stories of the war, but sort of through their eyes. That was kind of my mission at the time, right, was to maybe retell some of the stories we'd already heard, Fallujah, you know, some of these words, Abu Ghraib, you know, places you'd heard of, but it was like, well, what did that actually mean, or how did that actually happen from their side of the story? We'd only heard it from kind of the American side of the story, because that was the only story reporters could tell. And then in late 2010, a guy named Bouazizi in Tunisia set himself on fire. And the whole world, at least my world, totally changed, right? It was the beginning of what we now call the Arab Spring. Some people don't call it that anymore. I kind of still do, for reasons we can talk about in the questions if you like. Just one guy, he was a fruit vendor. I don't know if you remember the story. He was a fruit vendor, and he wasn't making very, he was making $2 a day, and a police officer, I think it was a female, these stories get apocryphal after time, don't they, insulted him, and for being poor, and for, you know, not making anything of himself. He was very well educated, like so many people in the Arab world. He was young, he was in his 20s, and he just decided he couldn't take it anymore, and he set himself on fire. And then a couple months later, he died. And when he died, thousands of Tunisians went into the streets. And then tens of thousands of Tunisians went into the streets. And then hundreds of thousands of Tunisians went into the streets. And then, you know, a few weeks later, the dictator of the country stepped down after decades being in power. And all of a sudden, literally, the entire region, I mean, it's hard. Again, I hope I did my job. I hope you imagined it when you were listening to my stories on NPR. But it's hard to really impart how monumental this was, like how completely and utterly enormous of a change this was in the region. All of a sudden, the 20-year-old disenfranchised were in charge. Like, they could all just, like, go to the streets and be like, yeah, sorry, we want you gone, and the guy would leave. You know, so what is that going to say to you if you're in Egypt or Libya or Syria or Bahrain or Yemen? Well, I'll do that too. That sounds like a great idea. Let's all go out and protest. And they did, by the millions, millions and millions and millions of 20 and 30-year-olds, educated, secular, motivated, brave souls in the streets across the region. asking for something different. I mean, first it was Tunisia, then it was Egypt, and then it worked, sort of, in Egypt. The dictator fell, right? And so every country, Bahrain, Yemen, Syria, Libya, of course, took to the streets. And I think that's something that probably gets forgotten as we look at the Middle East now, a couple years on. Everybody always asks me, oh, well, it's just a mess, right? Oh, they've been fighting each other for centuries, right? It's just the same old, same old. No, it's not the same old, same old. This was different. This is different. It is a moment where this enormous swath of the population that was born, you know, most of the Middle East, the average age is like 20 years old, 70% of the population, very young, deciding they want to say, they want some kind of say in how their future is going to be. So here I was in Baghdad. I was supposed to be, you know, following the story of U.S. troops in Baghdad. You know, the U.S. troops were going to pull out a year later. The NPR was not going to miss a day in Baghdad. That was our mandate. But I was like, coach, pick me. You know, like, I'd like to go to one of those stories, you know, please, hello. He kept this is my editor, you know, no, we got other people in this story. You're the young kid on the bench, you know, just sit back and bide your time. And I kept like, but please pick me. And finally he did, because at one point there were just not enough people to cover. There was literally protests in Bahrain, at simultaneous protests in Libya, Egypt, Bahrain, Syria hadn't started yet, and Yemen. So at least four countries. So we just didn't have enough people to cover it, because it means like a lot of people to cover these big, big protests. So I got to go. My joke is that I covered all the Arab uprisings that failed. The ones where by the time they started protesting, the dictator realized, oh, right, yeah, no, we're not going to let this happen. I'm not stepping down. I'm going to turn off the internet in my whole country, you know, or I'm going to, like, send out the police and shoot everybody instead of letting them protest enough to let me step down. So I got those. Those were not as fun. But again, it's not like I was talking to somebody's asking me, you know, how do you decide to go to war? You know, I was drafted in Vietnam. I didn't want to go. I wasn't choosing to go to war. I was choosing to go to the party. You know, I was choosing to go to the place where the good guys, at least for a minute, were winning. Just for a minute. You know, they won in Tunisia. They won in Egypt, sort of. They looked like they were going to win in Libya, sort of. And Bahrain, it was kind of looking kind of good for a while. So that's where I went. But then, of course, it didn't work out that way. Dictators got smart. They turned off the internet. They arrested people in droves. They jailed them. They tortured them. They beat them. They humiliated them. And in Syria's case, of course, they just outright killed them. And what was I going to do? It was still my mission to tell that story. So I did. But it wasn't easy. There were times, like Bahrain, once it turned off the internet, put everybody in jail, beat everybody. It also decided that journalists shouldn't probably be hanging around because, you know, we, like, tell the story to the world, and that doesn't really make them look good. So they'll kick all of us out of the country, too. But then a friend had told me about this service that was available called an e-visa for, like, businessmen to get a visa to Bahrain. And I was like, surely that's not still working. And he was like, try it. And I was like, okay. So I tried it, and I put in my passport number. I thought, no way they're going to let me through, because they know who I am. They know I'm a journalist. They're not going to let me through. Next day, I, like, get the e-visa emailed to me. I was like, okay, sounds good. So I print it out, and I get my flight to Bahrain, and I'm like, well, I probably shouldn't bring, like, a microphone, you know? I should probably, if I'm posing as a businessman, I should probably, woman, not bring anything. So I didn't bring anything. All I had was, like, my iPhone to do recording on and my laptop. And I remember when I got to the customs desk, the guy was like, you're here on business. And I was like, And he was like, and you are a, and I was like, consultant. He was like, for who? And I was like, JP Morgan. I still really don't know what or how that that I thought of that. Because I just, it didn't, it was just, yeah. You're not supposed to misrepresent yourself as a journalist, but I was on a higher mission, I thought, so I was trying to do that. Anyway, got in the country. I mean, we were able to interview people who had been treated just horribly, horribly, simply for the fact that they were protesting in the streets, simply for the fact, fired from their jobs, beaten, women put in jail, beaten, insulted, and speak things I won't even say here happened to them. It was awful, and here we were bearing witness. You know, that was my mission at that time. And honestly, I didn't think too much about, like, what it meant for me. You know, the worst thing that was going to happen to me, as I thought, was I'll get kicked out of the country, right? They catch me, they'll kick me out. Maybe they'll put me in jail, whatever. So then comes Syria. Same thing. Way worse scale. Tens of thousands of people in the streets. The very first day of protests in Syria. March 18th, 2011. Never forget the day. Bunch of guys go to the mosque on a Friday. And they... It's two mosques in this town called Daraa. It's southern Syria. And they had been talking to each other. So, you know what? After the prayers, let's just walk out on the street. Let's just walk outside and just say, freedom. Let's see what happens. It's a very repressive regime, right? The regime of Bashar al-Assad and his father before him, 5 decades of repression, right? They make Saddam look kind of nice. Let's just go outside. Let's say freedom. Let's say the government are thieves. These were sort of seemingly really benign phrases for us, right? And they did. And there's a guy I know I'll never forget because I always did stories about him over the years, a guy named Ibrahim. He was there that day. And he and his friends, they walked outside. They said freedom. There's a phrase in Arabic, when you open your chest, it means you're unarmed. It's kind of the equivalent of waving a white flag. In fact, Ibrahim went and took a big old flour sack and cut it and made it into this massive white banner, which is waving it in the street with his chest open to show we are not armed, we are peaceful, we're asking for freedom. And that the picture of him waving that banner was later kind of like the icon on Al Jazeera for a long time for Syrian uprising. It was Ibrahim. And security forces showed up and just shot him. Ibrahim's best friend right next to him, dead. Two other guys, dead. Another guy dead. 4 guys dead. Dead. Right there. Broad daylight. Just killed him. Just like that's the government's idea of like how they're going to deal with protests. So what happens, right? And this is the same thing that we saw in Egypt and Libya and everywhere else. There's a funeral for the guys who are killed and more people come out. And they protest. And what happens to the protesters? They get shot. There's another funeral. More protesters. They shoot more people. And it just grows and grows and grows. These regimes are not smart enough to think that killing people might actually make more protests. In the beginning of the Syrian uprising, it was probably like 10,000 people. By the end of that month, millions, right? Angry about the shootings, angry about the killings, angry about the deaths. The regime, the Syrian regime, of course, didn't care, didn't really care, and so just kept killing people, and has basically been killing people for 2 years. We're now in the hundreds of thousands. I don't need to go into all the details. If you want to ask me, fine. I lived and breathed Syria for 2 years. Happy to talk about it. Not happy to, but, you know, it's important. And so for me, as somebody whose mission it was to expose the injustice, to be a witness to history, I had to be there. I had to tell the world what was happening, especially as the world didn't react to Syria as it did to Libya. NATO stepped in Libya. NATO got, well, it's a complicated story, but got rid of Gaddafi, right? You know, the U.S. stepped in Egypt. We were on the phone with the government in Egypt behind the scenes, and that's why Mubarak stepped down. It's gotten more complicated since then, but, the world did nothing in Syria, so it was my job, it was my mission, as I saw it, to be there. To document it, to let those people know that they were not alone. I had a woman say to me once in a refugee camp, it was freezing, she was on a muddy floor, she had 6 children, the baby was covered in snot, and she held it out to me and she said, what, my Syrian children aren't as important as Libyans? Now, what was I supposed to say to that? So all I could say is, I can tell your story, and that's what I did. There comes a time, though, when the mission can eclipse your judgment. I don't know if I'd go so far as to say that I didn't have good judgment anymore because I didn't make stupid decisions. I never had any close calls. But at the same time, you know, I was in really dangerous places. This thing where it was the good guys, it was the good story, it was the fun party, turned into a war. And all of a sudden, I was a war correspondent and I didn't even know it. It was sort of like it just happened overnight. It was like, wait, what? I thought this was and so, you know, for me, the last few months has been a lot about just sort of recalibrating and trying to understand how the mission doesn't have to die if I'm not necessarily the one carrying it out. If you haven't heard the documentary, it's all about that. I'm not going to go into it too much, but I think it's just important when you think about mission and you think about how you can still do something important but it doesn't necessarily have to be the thing that puts you in harm's way. This is not to say that nobody should cover wars. I think people should cover wars. I think people should be a witness to history when there are human rights abuses. I think people should be there. I think we have to have that. I just don't necessarily think it has to be me all the time for years and years and years on end. I think it's probably more practical that people do it in shifts. that's one way. Small shifts. I think the people I know who've done it for years and years and decades are people who are not necessarily all that okay and sort of equipped to do. You know, someday I'm going to go back to Syria. I'm going to find Ibrahim. Don't you ever even think for a second that I am not going to go back there, find him, and continue telling his story and all the stories of all those other people that I met and that I know. But in order to do that, in order to be okay to do that, I had to get out alive, for one. And, you know, I had to get out kind of with my wits about me. So there's a new mission now. We all have them. We all go through changes. And now I'm a national correspondent for NPR. A lot of people have said, oh, you're going to have a hard time coming back. You know, like, that was kind of, you know, because there's, like, the documentary talks about, there's some buzz to being a war correspondent. There's adrenaline. You know, there's a lot of, it's kind of exciting. And I was like, yeah, I was kind of struggling with it. And then I went to the wild and woolly streets of Lincoln, Illinois. I was like, you know, I was kind of flailing around. I didn't know what I was going to do. And I got off I was going to see my mom. And, who's still working in Lincoln, and got off the train from Chicago. I'd come back from the Middle East, flew to Chicago, got off the train, and had that experience that a person has when they get off the train in their hometown and they haven't been there in a long time, like, what happened here? But then it was like, wait, no, really, what happened here? What happened? No, I really want to know. I'm a journalist, right? It's my job. This is why I love my job. I get to go out, learn things, tell people about them. So I spent like a week asking people, what happened here? Probation officer, police, friends, you know, teachers, and it became pretty clear that, like, Lincoln is sort of emblematic of a thing that's happening in a lot of the country, right, is a disappearing middle class. No surprise, been happening for decades, manufacturing jobs going away, the recession was no help, right? There are jobs coming back to America, but they are not middle-wage jobs. They're either high-wage jobs or low-wage jobs, and in places in Rust Belt states like Illinois and others, it's mostly low-wage jobs that are coming back. It's a struggle to get by. We know this, right? So all of a sudden I was like, wait, maybe I have a new mission. This kind of sounds interesting. So I went out with the police chief, and it was like a Tuesday afternoon. He was like, I'm sorry, it's going to be kind of boring, honey. You might have to come around and, like, hang out every night, late at night, to see something good. Not kidding. 15 minutes later, we get a call. He's like, go, 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 go. And I'm like, yeah. And I'm narrating it just like I would in Syria. Like, they've got guns. They're going. And he pulls up and, like, you know, busts these two guys who had 20 pounds of pot. He suspected it came from Mexico. Was selling it to a 14-year-old kid in Lincoln. They bust him at this hotel. And, like, three cop cars drove up. I was in the car narrating it the whole time. And I was sort of like, I think I'm good. Like, there's enough to talk about here in America. Not to diss Lincoln, to all you wonderful Lincoln people. That did happen. I'm sorry. It happened. I recorded it. It's on tape. So, you know, if anything, just to take away from tonight is sort of thinking about new missions and how they're not necessarily better or worse than the other ones, but, you know, it's okay to move on. That's something I need to say to myself, and I hope it's useful for you to hear as well. I'm going to open it up to questions, but while I have the floor, I'm going to do something that I don't usually get to do at events like this. Because it just so happens to be that there are a couple people here who aren't normally here at these events that I do. people always ask me, like, how do you do what you do? Like, were you weird as a kid or something? I'm like, I mean, was I? Like, I don't think, I mean, no, right? I didn't do anything adventurous. You did all the adventurous things. I mean, so, you know, I didn't, like, climb trees too much. I mean, I did broke my arm, like, swinging on the swing or whatever. Three times I broke my arm. Okay. Roller skating. And so it's only been recently that I've actually thought about it, about the answer to that question. And one of the answers that I know is that I had two parents who never stood in my way, like, ever. There are helicopter parents. People get involved in everything. It's not my parents. You know, tell you, no, I'm worried. Why are you doing this? What are you doing? Maybe they were thinking all of these things, but they never said it. And I just want to take this opportunity to thank them for being on the greatest mission of all, which is being just the two best parents in the whole world. So can you please join me? And Stephen Claudia McGovern. and also for like cashing all the checks and like dealing with the late night phone calls and just the all the bad. There's a lot of bad, but and they never complained. Anyway, so I'd love to just take questions if you guys are interested in asking. I would be happy to answer.
Kelly,
yes.
What's the current mission in California?
In California. So I'm a national correspondent. I happen to be based in California, but I'm sort of reporting on America. So I started with this story in Lincoln about what happens to a town when the middle class disappears. And I've been working on some stories about that in other places. So I've been in Oregon. I'm going to go to Texas in a couple weeks. So, yeah, I live in Los Angeles. The mission in Los Angeles is to, like, chill, which has been really nice. But the mission in terms of work is to, you know, report on my country. And the things that I saw when I came home, I mean, I was struck by my hometown, but I was also struck by, like, wow, it's a lot harder to get by right now. We know the recession, right? We're in a middling recovery, fine. But no, in general, like, it's harder to get by. What's going on with that? So my mission is to kind of follow my nose and sort of try to... So there's a lot of economic data out right now about the disappearing middle class. And there's all these economists who are doing all these nerdy, like, maps and stuff like that. So I'm taking that data and I'm just going to people and trying to find out and asking them, well, how is this affecting you? How is this affecting you? In the hopes that people will listen, people will connect, and that the policymakers, you know, will have a little more information as they go to the tables of power, whatever that means.
How important was it when you were a foreign correspondent to have other correspondents around to talk to you?
Hugely, yeah. We're a tribe. We call ourselves the tribe, especially in the Middle East and the war group. We lost a lot in 2012. A lot of people died. It's the deadliest year on record for journalists was 2012, and several of them were my friends. So we're tight, you know? We are there for each other. In a seemingly really competitive business, and it is, the news business is horrifically competitive, it's just a very tight group. And increasingly a group that is full of women. If you look at Syria coverage right now, in the United, you know, by major U.S. news organizations, the best people in the business, women. New York Times correspondent, Washington Post correspondent, NPR, Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine, all women doing that. So, I mean, I think, I'm not saying that's inherently better than anything else, but we just are a very supportive group in an otherwise horrifically competitive and mean industry. If there was any here, yeah, sure. What happened to the Occupy movement? No, I mean, yeah, of course. Yeah. Of course. You know, it's really one of the most interesting things that has happened to me since I got back. I've only been back for 2 months, and I've only been working for a month. But every time I go out to interview people, here's one thing that Americans do that, like, people in the Middle East don't do. They Google you, which is kind of weird. So it's like, oh, go to a meeting. You're like, yeah, I Googled you all night last night. I know all about you. And you're like, okay. But they say stuff to me like, this is a war. This is a revolution. They're, like, trying to relate it to my life, you know, like, as if, like, that's the only way I can understand America. This should be an uprising. And I'm like, oh, you know, hey, if that's the way you think, I'll be there, you know. But, yeah, sure, if there is some. Yes, sir. Of the what? Of the American people? Yes and no. I mean, America is the axis on which, you know, all disagreement spins in the Middle East, right? I mean, it's either, like, people really want us involved or people don't want us involved at all. So, you know, it just depends on which way the wind was blowing. Like, right now, I think because the army has taken over again in Egypt, you know, basically Mubarak's guys are all back in power in Egypt, right? I think there's a lot of people who are like, America... You know, where are you? But then, of course, if America gets too involved, they don't really want us, right? Iraq is kind of the same way. Iraq is hugely divided over whether it was a good idea that we got involved. It's mostly along sectarian lines, right? Shias are glad we came because they hated Saddam. He was a Sunni. Sunnis are glad or mad we came because they wanted Saddam. So it just depends. And with Syria, I mean, it's a huge... For me, that was the story I covered the most with Syria. right? So I had people, you know, the woman with the baby, I had people saying to me all the time, what is wrong? Where is your country? Why aren't you intervening? This guy is killing us. I mean, the regime of Syria, it didn't just shoot people at protests, like hit them with Scud missiles, airstrikes, rockets, mortars, people, civilians. Like right now, you could be sitting at church and there would be an airstrike on your church. That happens in Syria. And it's the government doing it to its own people. So these are people saying to me, where is your government? Why aren't you stepping in to stop this crime against humanity? And that's a question that obviously I can't answer because I don't work for the government. I can just say all I can do is tell your story. So, I mean, I think it depends. You know, a lot of people, Syrians usually, as a rule, hated Americans. You know, as a regime that sort of the propaganda of which was to hate Americans, the great Satan. But when it came to, you know, their own personal needs, they wanted us there. And we weren't there. And so then the anger, so then you have this, like, this the opposite effect, right, is that they get more and more angry with us, and now they really don't want us there, and they're sort of more angry at us for doing nothing. So that's not really created a great thing either. It's complicated in Syria for sure. The Christians are obviously, and the Christians of Egypt, the Christians of Syria, the Christians of Egypt, Christians of the Middle East. Christians of the Middle East have not had a good century, right? They were forced, in 1948 was a bad year. Especially Iraq, you know, Christians were forced out of Iraq. After the war, when Islamists took over, I think more Christians were forced out. Christians feel like they're in danger in Syria. There's this perception that the status quo is the best way forward if you're a minority group in the Middle East, whether you're Christian or Druze or Assyrian, Chaldean, that the dictator is probably your greatest protector. And this is the myth that the dictator has propagated among Syrians. I disagree. I mean, I think at the early stages of the uprising, you had Syrians across the board, all sects, all religions, saying, this isn't about religion, this is just about a new government. And Sunnis, who are the majority of Syria, saying, we'll protect our brothers. Syria is actually kind of a secular place. People didn't identify themselves. But as there's more violence, as there's more bloodshed, people, retreat to their groups and worry about how to protect their own. And the Christians of Syria in particular see Bashar al-Assad as, and by and large, not all Christians, but the majority of them see him as the protector. And that's a huge dividing line for Syrians. Are they in danger from the hard line Islamist groups? Yes. Does that mean the entire Syrian opposition is like that? Absolutely not. Yeah. Yep. So go ahead. This notion of, oh, they've been doing it for centuries and thousands of years, it's the same old problem, you know, there's nothing you can do, we might as well just stay away. You know, I just don't think that's true. I think it's a very dynamic place. Again, 70% of the population of the Middle East is under, like, 30. You know, this is a whole new Middle East. You know, yes, they're the sons of the fathers who grew up under the dictators, but because of that, they are a new generation. I mean, I think the biggest thing we would probably, you know, ignore to our peril going forward is that there's a real opportunity here to shape a new Middle East. And shape that how, of course, how does America get involved? How does an American get involved? A conversation that can go on for days and does. That's complicated. But I think if we just sort of say, oh, it's not our problem, and don't realize how closely connected we are, how it is in our interest in national security and otherwise, I think we would be foolish.
Mm-hmm. So I think that one of the problems is trying to understand the right way in terms of when the revolution first occurred as an attitude. I think there were a lot of positive attitudes. And of course, when the reality comes home, it creates a good deal of confusion, conflict in America about what's happening over there. So let me just take each of you as one example.
democracy is messy. It doesn't happen overnight. You're not just like, we had elections and so everything is fine. We've had 80 years of an Islamist political movement that believes in political parties. The Muslim Brotherhood is not, they're not jihadists, they're not crazy head choppers, they're religious people. It's as if Ralph Reed, you know, were, you know, head of a political party still. You know, they took power. People weren't happy with him. Oh, dear, that's democracy. Somebody gets elected who you don't like. Sound familiar? You know, I mean, that's what I would say. Is not like, oh, my God, it led to total chaos. I mean, after doing Syria, when I went to Egypt, I thought to myself, oh, Egypt's going to be fine. I mean, I know the news that you get is just like chaos, chaos, fire, fire, protest, shooting, blob. Egypt's a country of 80 million people. Like, you are getting the teeny tiniest, tiniest slice of what's happening in Egypt. By and large, it is a state. It is a state that will survive, is not a failed state by any means. That's messy. It's just going to be tough, you know, for them to figure out, how do we go forward? Do we actually, you know, I think there's all this huge backlash. The country decided, well, maybe we don't want democracy. That was kind of scary and weird because we got this Islamist guy in there who's kind of dorky and not very smart and doesn't, you know, put a good face on and rolled back some freedoms and stuff. But, I mean, that's what I would say, is that democracy is messy, and this is just not going to, like, resolve itself overnight. And the worst thing we could do is walk away. Yes. And in Oregon and in Providence, and there's. Sure. World's second largest oil producer in the world. I mean, there's a lot. Money is the biggest. Iraq's biggest problem is money. You know, if it had no money, it actually would have a chance. Oil economies are rarely, except for the you know, Northern Europe, right? Rarely a good recipe for democracy, unless democracy is already in place first. How can you know? How can you know that until it's tried? I mean, it's tried in a couple places, and it's not going well, and we're only 2 years in. That would be my response. In fairness, you know, I mean, Russia, no, is not currently on a path to democracy. That is certainly true. Is overnight democracy the way? I mean, I think there's a whole lot of great lessons we can learn from the Arab Spring. But one of them I would say is, like, we don't know yet. Like, we really don't. I mean, we're 20 years on in Russia. We can kind of look back and say, since the, you know, the 93. So we can, you know, we can look back and say, okay, well, here's some stuff that went wrong. But, I mean, we're 2 years into the Arab Spring, and Egypt is going bad. Tunisia, one to watch. Messy, super messy. There's not very much money there. There's no major resource like oil. That's actually a good thing. Again, you've got literally, like, cafes across the country. I've got friends who live there. Know that, you know, cafes across the country, you've got 25-year-olds sitting around writing constitutions. You know, that's what they spend their time. That makes me excited. There's a lot of stumbling blocks, but that makes me think that, like, this could actually work out. There's been a lot of studies done about if a regime is overthrown without violence, it has much more likelihood of going forward nonviolently. You know, of course, the case of Libya is not such a good one because he was overthrown so violently. And then Egypt is kind of an interesting case. Yemen is also this really interesting case, too. He wasn't overthrown violently. He was sort of coerced into stepping down. Of course, that was after they tried to assassinate him and, like, almost burned him to death. But that's all a whole, yeah, it was detailed. But anyway, I mean, there was this kind of transition process, and there's this national dialogue going on. It's going to be going on for a year, where people are in this, like, auditorium like this, literally throwing chairs at each other. There's always a fight. Everybody's mad, but they're talking. Everybody's at the table about, like, how do we make a country? How do we go forward? Super messy, but I just feel like the jury isn't out on a couple of those places yet. Yep. Right. 10 years of conflict. You know, you just kind of can't go back from where we are now. There's too much blood has been shed, and blood is answered in blood in the Middle East to some degree. Revenge is a powerful thing. You know, I had a guy once say to me, like, I have 7 sons. If I lose a few, it's okay. But by now, he's probably lost all 7. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, that's really where we're at. Hundreds of thousands of people have been killed, and it's real. I mean, it's just a decimated place. And so it's possible that it may just have to go through the awful ringer before we know what's next. I'm sad to say that. Oh, people who've left? Millions. I mean, anybody who can get out gets out. I mean, Syria is bordered by Jordan, Iraq, Turkey, Lebanon, and Israel, and there's probably 6 million registered refugees just in the neighboring countries. And then inside the country, another 5 to 10 million who are displaced from their own homes and can't even get out if they wanted to. There's only 22 million Syrians, period. Probably, because they had no choice, but yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. I mean, I hope that my prediction is wrong. Yeah, I'm a journalist, so I can report what I know. It's not my job to give opinions, really. What I know is that he did it. Bashar al-Assad did it. You know, if there's any sort of doubt that it was like, oh, maybe it was the rebels who used the chemical weapons, I'm sorry. I know the people who did the reports for the United Nations and the Human Rights Watch, and I know they're the best people in the business. He did it. So that I know as a journalist. You know, how you go forward with information like that is, you know, for people who make more money than me. But what was the first part about where it's going to go? Oh, going. I mean, there's some stuff on the table. Look, the U.S. administration's ideal scenario is that these chemical weapons get destroyed and that somehow Bashar al-Assad feels enough pressure on the ground, just enough, right? And that's why we've been arming and training certain vetted rebel groups. We've been doing it for like a year. Everybody's like, what if we train? I was like, we've been doing it for a year. I met the guys. I know. We've been doing it for a year. That we can, by training and arming some of these sort of vetted, not like crazy head chopper rebels, but just sort of regular rebels, that if we can turn the tide on the battlefield enough that Bashar al-Assad feels the pressure, that he actually sees the writing on the wall, that he, like Ali Abdullah Saleh in Yemen, will wise up and, like Zine Abidine al-Ali in Tunis, wise up and step down. Or enter into a peace process that eventually sees his negotiation out of power. That is the United States administration's dream. It has been for 2 years. The dream's not coming true. My sense is that Bashar al-Assad will hang on until the last drop of blood. But that's, no one's certain of that either. The Russians and the Iranians are the interesting card here, right? They have all the influence over him. They obviously influenced him on the chemical weapons decision. That was a pretty big breakthrough, actually, diplomatically, to sort of get the Russians on the other side. There's this Geneva II peace process that's still on the table, constantly being talked about, may never happen. That's the dream scenario, is that everybody comes to the table and everybody figures out how to get rid of Bashar. Sunnis are 70% of the country in Syria, and Bashar comes from a small elite. And he and his father, like I said, ruled the country for decades. Like, at some point, the majority of Syrians are going to rule Syria. How we get there, we don't know. No, until the foreign powers stop arming the rebels. But what he says in public, I mean, it's just you read the tea leaves and then you kind of move on. Because he didn't use chemical weapons either, even though they're destroying them right now. Like, he didn't have them, but now they're in the country destroying them. So, I mean, you know, when he, like, talks publicly, it's sort of silly.
Two questions. Assad's father,
Hafez,
and so forth, Hafez Assad and then the son goes to studies ophthalmology, so forth and so on.
London, marries a British Syrian, she's beautiful, she wears Jimmy Choo shoes, yeah. So big spread about her in Vogue, the Desert Rose.
It disappears pretty quickly.
Yeah. Was it Vogue or, yeah, Vanity Fair. Saif al-Qaddafi, you know, it's the sons are always the scary ones, you know. That's what people say. I mean, who knows, right? These inner circles, like, we don't know anything about them. We can speculate all we want, you know, but, I mean, I think looking back on the Qaddafi family and the Assad family, I think we can all say, just because you go to the London School of Economics and you talk the talk and you wear the nice suit, you know, it doesn't mean that you're really any different on the inside. At the end of the day, you're going to stop protecting your tribe, your people, your family. You know, that's really what he's doing. It's not ideological. It's self-preservation, period.
Well,
the end.
Related to that thing is, what's the relationship that you know of in terms of the leadership of the Syrian army and the Russians?
Would love to know. No, but I mean, we don't know.
Assad,
we can guess.
Tomorrow,
right, and what would happen?
Mubarak disappeared and the Egyptian army is still there.
Right.
So is Assad sort of like North Korea? We're not sure who's really running the
We don't. We do not know. His brother Maher is really powerful. There's constant rumors that he's really the one running the show, that if Bashar wanted to leave, they'd kill him. Who knows? There was this weird assassination last year when Bashar's brother-in-law was assassinated, and they were like, oh, the rebels. And it was like, if the rebels could get that close to you, I mean, he did it. You know, I mean, it's just, who knows? Like, very, very, very secretive world, right? That's what the U.S. administration worries about, too, is that we saw it in Iraq, right? Not only did Saddam was toppled, and then in the next days, Paul Bremer, the U.S. administrator in Iraq, fired 50,000 people in Saddam's government. And if you look back, that was probably not a good idea, right? And so that's why Egypt went the way it did, right? We were on the phone with the generals. Okay, let's make this easy. Let's make it a transition. Let's leave the deep state in place. Let's just sort of lop off the figurehead. Okay, that didn't really work out well. So they're trying to, and as they sit down and hash out what's going on in Syria, this is always on their minds. Iraq is always in the rearview mirror. So is Egypt. It's like, and Yemen, you know, it's like, how do you, you know, how many people do you get rid of? You know, so it's like, okay, well, you decide, we're only going to get rid of the ones who have blood on their hands. The only, you know, well, how do you decide that if there's no records or it's a hugely secret? I mean, the transitional justice process, as we saw in the Balkans, could be something that goes on for decades and decades and decades. It's a huge question, though. So I think our administration, you know, wisely, we actually, one of the best diplomats in the business is our ambassador to Syria. He's very quiet. You never hear about him because he's working so hard. He's really, really good, just objectively. And I think this has been something he's worried about because he was in Iraq for a bunch of years, is like, we can't just, you know, come in and do a Saddam on him. We can't just topple this regime. There's a whole state to deal with. And if that whole state takes off or collapses, then the country itself will collapse. So what do you do? Not an easy question. So Russia has those relationships with those generals and with those ministers more so than we ever will. It's not like we have, like, intel on the ground with these guys. So they're our key, and they always have been. And what have they been? Totally recalcitrant and stubborn and unwilling to help. So it's been a stalemate, I mean, diplomatically, this whole time.
Well,
until the chemical attack, which is disgusting, that that was this diplomatic opening. Yes. Yeah. Oh, and the artifacts. Oh, my God. Syria is a place like unlike any. I was literally on a battlefield one day, and we were kind of going. I mean, I wasn't really. I mean, it was the battle. It was like there was a battlefield over there, and we were kind of going over here. And I was like, what is all these ruins? And it was like a Byzantine village, you know, from the 4th century that people were living in, the burial caves underground, because that was the only place where the bombs wouldn't get you. So, yeah, this rich, vast archaeological treasure is, and it's much more, there's much more there than there is in Iraq. They're just by nature of what it is. Two of the oldest cities in the world, Damascus and Aleppo, is not doing well. Lots of stuff appearing on the art markets. You know, people trying their best to track it, but it's hard because it's not the biggest priority. The biggest priority now is like polio has broken out in Syria again. You know, the regime is starving people out, you know, like just a roof over millions of people's heads is the priority right now. Yeah, sorry, not very uplifting conversation. Yep. Yeah, it's kind of an equal distribution. There's probably more Brits in the business than, like, they're more representative in the news business than they are in just the general world population. But otherwise, it seems pretty, you know, there's a lot of Yankees out there. You know, a lot of Brits in TV. I don't know. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. There's not a lot of radio. Nobody else really does radio. I mean, the BBC does radio, but it's kind of like an afterthought. After you file, like, your TV report, then you file your radio report. Or you might, at the end of a long week, do sort of a long radio report or something, and they'll two-way you, or they'll send out a separate reporter. But there's not. I mean, radio's kind of this, we're kind of this weird. NPR is this unique and wonderful thing where it's, like, a primary source of news that's just on the radio. It's not like that in most places. She doesn't really know. I mean, the other day she was like, Mom, can we stay here forever? And I was like, sure. And then like 2 days later, she's like, hey, Mom, where are we going next? And so, like, I just feel like that's kind of emblematic of how she is. Like, she doesn't know, you know. I mean, I think there are many reasons why I decided to take a break from this work. And one of them was that she was kind of getting old enough and coherent enough to kind of start getting it, you know. Their worlds are very small when they're like 3 years old. It's like preschool and house. Yeah, she went to an international school, you know, walked to school, trees and friends and birthday parties and the same thing that any 3-year-old would do. And, you know, the one time there was a car bomb in our city, we didn't talk about it around her, you know, and we made sure that no one was talking, you know, all of us with kids, all our friends with kids, we all had kids, you know, like put him to bed. Or the gin, now start talking about it. I don't know if she has like an awareness of, she'll say, that reminds me of Beirut, but like, does she know what that means? Is it any different in her mind than LA? Probably really not at this point. Maybe not. Check back in with her, she's 18 and she hates me. And she's really mad at me for all that. That's good. Well, thank you ever so much. Thanks a bunch. I appreciate it.
Again, thanks, Kelly, very much for coming and doing this for us. We really appreciate it. And I feel like I have a much better perspective. So, just for a second, there are several WIS staff members here. If I could ask you to stand just in case people wanted to see what you look like. They all dress up really well. So thank you very much for all the help. They work really hard to make these things happen. And Amanda has her camera, so if anybody would like to get a picture over here with Kelly or one of the staff members, go over by the WUIS sign, and she'll be happy to take some pictures. Again, thanks so much for coming and supporting WUIS and public radio.